So today I'm going to talk about the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, or the divine abodes. And they're all connected. And the way I first learned them is that they all support each other. And I'll talk a little bit about how, especially this fourth one, tends to be of support to the other three. Tim, for example, spoke of sympathy or sympathetic joy, mudita. And he spoke about how sympathy is like three quarters of compassion. So we can see right there that there's a connection between mudita and compassion. He also talked about how it's related to it because we feel somebody else's feeling and we sympathize with it. What's missing from mudita that compassion has is this pull that we feel to alleviate suffering when we meet it. And it's easier to see that in the way we react to the pain of another. And some of us can see it in ourselves, and some of us are learning to see it in ourselves. Can we respond with that same natural care that we give, you know, a suffering animal to ourselves when we're suffering? So the fourth Brahma Vihara, it's translated as equanimity. And in the Pali language, it's pronounced upekkha. And I just like that word, I don't know why. U-P-E-K-K-A is the way I spell it. And it balances all three of the other Brahma Viharas. So what is it, right? Well, part of what we're trying to do here in these talks is describe the indescribable, right? Like, how do you describe a moment of meditation? How do you describe an experience? So we're just pointing towards it. And I struggled a little bit with the idea that it seems harder to explain than some of the others. And part of it's probably because I understand it less, and part of it is just that it's maybe a little bit less concrete. Like, we all know that feeling of compassion, right? We know when we feel the suffering of another and we want to alleviate it. We all know when we're wishing a friend kindness. You know, but we don't say to each other, oh yeah, yesterday I had the coolest feeling of equanimity. You know, like when you said that, I felt really equanimous. But it is something we can tap into. So Wikipedia, the first choice of Dharma teachers everywhere, and mindfulness teachers everywhere, I kid you not, quote, equanimity is neither a thought nor an emotion. It's rather the steady, conscious realization of reality's transience. So it's got this awareness that things are transient. And it's the ground, it goes on to say, it's the ground of freedom and wisdom and the protector of compassion and love. And I thought about giving a whole talk about how connecting with transience, how can that be liberating and freeing? And that's another talk, but it's a lovely topic to explore. And I'll just say that as I talk about equanimity, think about applying it. Well, actually, forget that. I'm going to mention a few things. So one of the texts Tim and I have been referring to describe equanimity as being, quote, characterized as promoting the aspect of neutrality towards human beings. Characterized as promoting neutrality towards human beings. And I read that and I thought, well, that's kind of a drag. Like, yeah, I'm neutral. I don't care. That's who I think of neutral. But that's not what it means. Because it goes on to say, its function is to see equality in all beings. And then it goes on to say that it shows up as the quieting of approval and resentment. Now, the quieting of resentment, that's cool, but I don't know, I kind of like approval, right? We all kind of like it. So what is this thing, approval? And what they're talking about, they're not talking about all approval, but they're talking about the approval of one thing over another, right? Like if I approve of this person, does that mean that I don't approve of another person as much, right? If I approve of this thing, you know, do I not approve of another? And I think in that sense, it's useful to think of the quieting of approval. Maybe the quieting of preference or preferential treatment might be another way to think about it. And, you know, I was reading this and I was struck a little bit. Tim mentioned yesterday the importance to him of understanding how his privilege impacts his desire to see things clearly and honestly. And I really appreciated that. I really appreciate when people, you know, speak about that. And the notion of equanimity and its emphasis on this equality really motivates me in a deep way to understand inequality in the world, but first and foremost, as a mindful practitioner, in myself. And it made me think about the fact that I've spent the last year or two doing a lot of learning about the prejudice and the bias inside of me. It's a wonderful exploration if we can be a little bit grounded, a little equanimous with it. And I think it's useful to mention that my understanding of equanimity is inclusive of this practice of looking and seeing bias and prejudice clearly in our own minds, and engaging with the world to move the whole world, not just ourselves, towards this equality, this idea that there's a place, that the world is a place where everyone is equally welcome and equally belongs. Everybody, regardless of anything, race, gender, sexual preference, to name a few, age, body type, physical or mental ability, everyone has what they need to live a full and happy life, free from oppression or prejudice, free to be themselves, free to practice meditation or mindfulness. I also realize that I feel a bit strange as a cisgendered male heterosexual American talking about this, but it's who I am, and I'm finding my role in helping people move towards that, and learning that really, increasingly, I'm understanding my role is to be of support, as opposed to telling people what I know from my place of privilege, and to be very open to understanding. In some ways, it's just like meditation practice. I sit, and I listen, and I realize I don't know, and I try to learn. And I do believe very strongly that the roots of mindfulness, Buddhism, support this exploration and points towards a world where we are all equal and we're all also valued for our uniqueness. And I just think that's a lovely aspiration. So, and that just arose in my contemplation of equanimity, reading some of these texts, and thought I would share it. So one Pali scholar, who's a teacher of mine for many years, he explains back to equanimity that equanimity is one of the most sublime emotions of Buddhist practice. And again, when I first heard the word sublime, I'm like, that's boring. Sublime means boring. But it really doesn't mean boring. It might mean subtle. It might mean effusive, like it spreads out everywhere. And he explains also in this article that it's the ground, equanimity is the ground for wisdom and freedom and the protector of compassion and love. And then he gets into the scholarly part of dissecting the word. The first root of equanimity, equanimity is made up of sort of two halves in the original language. And I get bored by the details, so I won't share them all. But there's more reading to be done if you're interested. But half of the root, it's fascinating, half of the root of upekkha, of equanimity in the Pali language, means to look over. And it refers to the equanimity that arises when we practice seeing without being caught by what we see. Those are his words. So to look over and to practice seeing without being caught by what we see, and equanimity arises as a result of that, as a product of that. He goes on to say that when it's well developed, it gives rise to a sense of peace. So this simple practice that we're doing of just noticing and trying not to get caught by what we notice, and maybe for a moment sometimes we don't get caught, it leads to equanimity, and equanimity gives rise to a sense of peace. We're doing something so simple, yet so profound. The other half of the word is made up of three different words. And when you put them together, those words mean to stand in the middle of all this. So equanimity arises by seeing without being caught, gives rise to a sense of peace, and it means standing in the middle of all this. And being in the middle refers to balance, to being centered with whatever is happening. And it's explained that it comes from an inner strength, an inner stability. And the final quote from this description and definition of equanimity: the strong presence of inner calm, well-being, confidence, vitality, or integrity can keep us upright like a ballast keeps a ship upright in strong winds. As inner strength develops, and I'm adding the words, just being able to sit and be with, it's a tremendously subtle but powerful form of strength. As inner strength develops, equanimity follows. I thought to myself, you know, what I've heard some people say, it's kind of like the word some people use, flow. When you're in the middle of something, it could be a sport, it could be an artistic endeavor, it could be listening to music. In the middle of flow, and you're okay with the fluidity and the transience of everything. Like if you're speeding on a bicycle, you know, or the windows in the car open, you're just going down the hill, and you're just sort of in the moment. And everything's changing around you. It's not all still and fixed, but you're okay with it. The changing nature of things, and there's a calm in the midst of this movement. I also thought about, as I was walking this morning, the bay right here. When it's calm, like when it's not all windy and choppy, it's really expansive, maybe sublime, if I fully knew what that meant. And it's seemingly peaceful, right? I mean, some of us look out at it and we get a feeling of peace from it. But it's totally moving and changing at the same time. I mean, the entire, like, you know, millions of gallons of water are moving in and out with the tides. You know, there's so much happening there. Yet there's this stillness and this peacefulness. Other examples from nature that struck me, I was watching this blue heron sitting on a log, and my first thought was, oh, wow, it's really peaceful. It's really equanimous. And then the thought came to me, or maybe it's just a really good hunter. And maybe it's just sitting there waiting for its prey. And then it got up and it started to fly. And there was something in its flight that was peaceful, that was equanimous. It didn't seem to be making a lot of effort, but certainly it had to be making some effort. But the wings were moving in this fluid, changing motion that had a peacefulness to it. So I'm sort of pointing to things that give me that feeling, because I find sometimes just defining it falls short. So what isn't? What is equanimity not? Okay? Some people think of equanimity as this dry neutrality or cool aloofness. The same is true with mindfulness practice or Buddhism. But in reality, it's a mature equanimity produces a radiance and a warmth of being. Okay, we're not like stepped back and disconnected and it's all cool. We're actually in the world. We're not just letting everything be as it is. You know, sometimes I hear a fair amount, the two most common things I hear from people who are curious about learning more about mindfulness or Buddhism is, so aren't you people like all just okay with everything and really don't care about anything? You're just like, whatever, the world can do what it does, right? And you don't want anything, you know, the ultimate, it's all good. But these practices were developed to connect us more fully with our lives, not to separate us or distance us in order to feel okay. We do that well enough on our own. We don't need a practice to do that. And we learn to cultivate these things in the midst of our lives. A great example of this came up with a question somebody asked over the last few days around this notion of compassion, right? Do I extend compassion to everybody and therefore whatever you're doing is okay? And there's this beautiful concept called fierce compassion, which is, I care about your well-being and your suffering, and I care about my well-being and my suffering. And I see you or me suffering at the hands of someone else or some injustice, and compassion compels me to say, no, this isn't okay. I'm not okay with this. I can see it clearly. I can be with it, but my understanding is that we're not supposed to just be cool with it. So fierce compassion is a very powerful idea. And I encourage the contemplation of what does it mean to be okay and to be present? And then what does it mean to then take this seeing and then decide what's appropriate action? One teacher in the lineage that Tim has studied likes to say that Buddhism is just a practice of cultivating an appropriate response. So what benefit is equanimity, in addition to some of the things I've mentioned? It supports the other three Brahma Viharas. And by providing a sense of balance and perhaps a sense of inner strength, ideally balance that comes from inner strength. So, for example, kindness, when there's equanimity, when there's some balance, it doesn't become attachment or overindulgent. It stays balanced, right? I want to be kind, but I'm not going to give you everything that I have and neglect myself. I want to be kind to myself, but I'm not just going to sit under the covers and eat ice cream sundaes all day every day because I think that's what would feel good. There's balance. With equanimity, compassion does not become pity. And that could be a whole talk unto itself. Because what often happens is compassion, either it's pity and we sort of are looking down at the other person, right? Oh, poor you. You know, we sort of put them on a different level all of a sudden instead of being equal. Or compassion becomes something that pulls us in to the point where really we're of no support. You know, it's like someone's drowning in suffering, so we jump in the pool with them. That doesn't help either of us, right? So equanimity helps us to know, how do I maintain a sense of inner strength and balance and still care for and respond to your suffering or my suffering? Yeah. How do I stay balanced and feel my suffering? Not fall all the way into it and lose all sense of balance, but tap into it enough to feel it and then see what seems appropriate in the moment. And sympathetic joy, or mudita, that Tim talked about yesterday, doesn't become comparison or insincerity or joy at the material success of others. It stays connected to the genuine wish that others be happy, that they know joy. Another benefit of equanimity is it leads to the release of suffering or stress or tension. As mentioned before, it can lead to a deep sense of peace. And this peace itself can be balanced. It becomes peace or contentment without complacency. I went through a period in my practice where I discovered a peace and an ease that I had never tasted before. Like everything, it didn't last in the way that it first arose, but you know, to know it's there and be able to access it at times or have it arise, it's still very, 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 very useful even when it's not there. I sort of borrow my own confidence in a sense. But I was told that the near enemy, it's not just that the Brahma Viharas have near enemies, everything has a near enemy in Buddhist psychology. And I remember being told, you know, this contentment that you're feeling is great, be careful of the near enemy. And the near enemy of contentment is complacency. I'm so content, I don't care about anything else. And equanimity balances that. So I'm going to go on a little side journey. It's related to equanimity. And it has to do with this notion of happiness we're always talking about. You know, Buddhism likes to say, you know, it's described as a way to end suffering in its ultimate form, or conversely, to bring about happiness. And we think of happiness as getting what we want or getting rid of what we don't want. And we all live this every day. Our minds are machines. And what these machines seem to do some of the time, most of the time, is generate endless preference. Right? You can't not do it. It's happening here when there's so little going on, right? There's people we like and don't like who we've never spoken to, right? But we've conjured up this preference. We have endless ideas about what we need to have to feel okay and what we need to get rid of to feel okay. And part of retreat is settling down, slowing down, and beginning to see this, right? It's not just that the world presents these things I need to rearrange to be happy. Right? When most of the things in the world that we deal with are gone, these habits are still there. Just what the mind does. And it's really useful to see it. It happens during our meditation practice. I like this, I don't like this, I want more of this, I want less of this. My meditation would be great if only, right, I got rid of this, or if only that one feeling I had for 10 seconds 3 years ago, could I just get that back? Just for 45 minutes, come on. Right? And it happens off the cushion. You know, it happens with our meals, it happens with the temperature. We have nothing, more or less, to do here, right? Except follow the schedule. Yet our mind still plans it all out, ponders the options, creates a world at times just as or more seemingly complicated than our home life, right in the middle of this simplicity of this retreat. And that's just our minds wanting us to be happy, thinking, telling us not knowing, not to believe it, or the habit of believing it our whole lives, which we all do. I do it all the time. Oh, if I get rid of this, I'll be happy. And if I get more of this, I'll be happy. One teacher of mine once said, you know, the proof he needed to see that this formula doesn't work is because if it did work, he only would have ever needed one piece of chocolate. Right? He would have had it, he would have been satisfied, everything would have been okay. I remember years ago I moved, sort of the age of computers just starting. I think I had one computer, and I don't even remember. Yeah, I had one, and we were going to get a new one. And we had just moved, and I was learning what computers could do. And I was probably a little anxious, you know, the way sometimes transitions can do. And I remember sitting at the old computer, and turning back and saying to my wife, you know, this computer, it can't do, it's something, I was trying to do some document and it wouldn't print. This is like 20 years ago or something. So when the new computer comes, like, I'll be able to like get this document in the form I need and be able to print it. And she's like, yeah, that's great. And a few minutes later, I'm like, when the new computer comes, like, we'll be able to hook up to the internet and actually send email to other people, get emails back, you know, like, because our computer doesn't do that. She's like, yeah, that's great. A few minutes later, when the new computer comes, I think we can get music to play through it. Like, I was just so excited, investing all this. And she came over to me, and it was kind, it wasn't mean, because she knows me. She put her hand on my shoulder and said, when the new computer comes, finally, everything is going to be okay. And poof, I was like, oh yeah, everything's okay right now. But I still got the computer. But it didn't give me eternal happiness. And the reason that's the case, right, is because really, nothing lasts, and nothing measures up to what we think, and inherently, getting things and getting rid of things doesn't lead to lasting happiness. The formula is flawed. But we can convince ourselves it's not, because we know, like, we get the hit sometimes, like, you know, I get the piece of chocolate, and like, for a moment, I'm happy. You know, I'm happy in the way I'm happy when I get a piece of chocolate I like. But that moment doesn't last, or it changes, or the chocolate is gone, and my mind says, you just need one more piece to be happy, right? And that's the nature of things, and there's an inevitable letdown, and something in us knows that we're not fulfilled, right? But without some kind of a practice to begin to learn to see it, the mind says, I know the answer, you just need something else. Or you need to get rid of something else. And so the mind looks around and it sees something that's pleasant or unpleasant. So it wants either more of it or less of it. And that becomes the next thing. And this is all natural. And none of us would be here if our ancestors didn't do this, because they wouldn't have survived. Right? We need to have some preference. We need to have some ability to know what we need and don't need. And some of the things, you know, if I said, oh yeah, I have no preference, I'll just lay outside in the freezing cold and not eat for 10 years and see how that goes. So it's an important part of our survival. And some wants are necessary to our well-being. You didn't just appear here on retreat, you didn't snap your fingers. There was a lot of work, a lot of effort, a lot of preference, a lot of getting rid of things and getting other things in place. And there's this idea in Buddhism that wanting causes stress. And if we get rid of wanting, we'd be happy. And for a long time, that's kind of how I thought of it. And I kept rubbing up against this thing. Well, you know, it doesn't seem that harmful to want some things, right? And you have to look at what you're willing to do to get them and all of that. But then I heard this teaching that really stuck with me. And it was an understanding that in the early texts, it's not wanting. The word doesn't translate as wanting or as desire. Desire is just something that arises. But it's clinging to desire, specifically clinging to the idea that I need this thing that I desire in order to be happy, or I need to get rid of this thing that I don't like. So it's fine to prefer blueberries over strawberries, or, you know, chocolate over cantaloupe. But if I think, you know, I'm not going to be happy if I don't get chocolate, and darn it, there's the cantaloupe again, you know, I'm clinging to it. So, for example, there's a difference in tone in when I have the desire for something, when I'm clinging to it, and when I'm not, you know? And I noticed this recently. I was shopping for a guitar. And what I realized at a certain point was, unlike years ago when I last shopped for guitar, I felt like I gotta have it, I don't like the one I have, and it's really stressful, what if I pick the wrong one, and what's the return policy, and all this stuff, right? You know, but I know if I get the right one, you know, I'll be happier, right? And I noticed, I was like, you know, yeah, I'd like a nicer guitar. I think it would give me some joy, but if I don't find one, that's okay. So there was desire without clinging, and I noticed that. And it felt really liberating. Like, I actually enjoyed the process of shopping, which I almost never do. It's not my thing, you know? But I enjoyed the process because I didn't feel like I had to somehow get somewhere. My happiness wasn't dependent on it. I was gonna be in a good mood, a bad mood, miserable, happy that day, whether or not I found a guitar I liked. And there's a lot of freedom in that. And there's a lot of equanimity in that. And this is the result of practice. Without even trying to make it happen, just by showing up for our lives in the present moment with curiosity or patience, or when that's not there, just showing up for whatever is happening. And again, it's what we're doing on retreat, what we do when we meditate. Just by doing the simple practice, this happens over time, without even trying to. One explanation of the moment when we get something we like, that hit that we get, that I really like, is that it's not even the thing that we get that's giving us this sense of okayness. It's the fact that for just a moment, we're not clinging to anything, right? We're just being, I'm just eating the chocolate. My mind hasn't yet gone to, I need another piece. So it quells this fire of clinging. How nice is it not to want anything, even for a moment? Right? And that's kind of what we're practicing when we meditate. We're practicing noticing, and at times we're noticing the absence of wanting. Or we practice allowing whatever's there. And you can practice allowing the not allowing. Oftentimes I'll be there and I'll be like, wow, my mind just wants and wants and wants, and I'm fighting the wanting. I'm like, what if I just let myself want? What if I don't make wanting a problem? What if the problem is that I'm making it a problem? What if just, okay, I'm gonna give myself 45 minutes to be whatever, I wanna be self-critical, greedy, selfish, self-obsessed human being who just thinks about the things that they want and is resentful that my mind isn't doing what it wants. What if I just let myself be like that? So I can allow the not allowing. And it's really simple. We sit, we notice, we wander, we return. And in doing this, the mind is reconditioned without us doing it. You know, the mind, that part happens on its own like a plant growing. So we're setting the conditions and the mind stops always going to what it's used to thinking, but we've been trained to teach what, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of messages a day we get in the media telling us we'll be happier if we get X, Y, or Z. No wonder we have this habit. And so we come back to the present moment, which leads to the question of why all this emphasis on the present moment? Well, for one thing, it's the only thing that's really there. I remember one teacher of mine saying, you're not gonna learn to meet the moment yesterday. And you're not gonna learn to meet it tomorrow. You know, tomorrow's not here. And then she said this thing that I always talk about. She goes, and breakfast, where's breakfast? She said, for all intents and purposes, it is with the dinosaurs. That's how much access you have to eating breakfast, right? And I think about that sometimes. I think about, I really want this thing. Like a simple thing. I'll be at home, and there'll be a discussion, you know, should we make something for dinner? You want to go grab a bite, right? You know, so have this conversation. And I noticed for years, I had a preference for grabbing a bite, right? And I realized at one point that in an hour, the experience of dinner is going to be back with the dinosaurs. And my happiness is really not dependent on whether we go grab a bite or whether we make something. It's quite interesting. And I was like, okay, let me note this, put a marker here. And then an hour, I'm going to, you know, look back and say, is that really true? And sure enough, after dinner, it really didn't impact my life one way or the other. And you could notice that with other preferences, right? Like maybe at a meal, take a little less of something that you really like, just a little bit, and then say, okay, I'm going to see if at the end of the meal I'm any happier or less happy. Right? Our mind tells us we will be. We've got to have more of that and less of that. So if part of freedom from suffering is letting things be, and the only place we can let things be is in the present moment, that's why we practice keep coming back. In the words of mindfulness-based stress reduction, one of the benefits of practice and of equanimity is that it helps us to see the pause between something happening and our reaction to it. So if I'm using my hands, if your eyes are closed, you can choose to open them or not. But if this is the present moment, and here's me approaching the present moment, and here's me afterwards saying, wow, I can't believe I just did that. That was so unskillful, or that was so reactive, right? Well, people say all the time, well, how's that going to help me to see that? What happens is, as we go through our life and we practice being present, this gap here that it takes till we look back and see what we did gets shorter and shorter. Oh, I can't believe I just did that. Just as we're finishing saying that thing, we realize, oh, I can't believe I just said that. Over time, we begin to see it as it's happening. And then eventually, we begin, well, first what seems to happen is I begin to see it as it's happening and I can't do anything about it. Uh-oh, I'm about to say this. Can I stop? No. Oh, I can't believe that. But that gap gets to the other side of the thing, of the event, or the occurrence, or the feeling, or the attitude, or the belief, and there's a space there, and there's a gap there. And really, the whole of practice, in some ways, is simply doing what we can to increase the likelihood that that gap is there, so then we can stop, be a little bit more spacious, a little more equanimous, and then choose what to do. And make a choice based on what actually might lead to my well-being or the well-being of others. Not how much more memory can I get in that computer if I call up now and change the order. And these things don't just come and stay, right? Equanimity, peacefulness, they come and they go. And it's really important to know that about practice. You know, I didn't get to the point where my mind was peaceful and calm through the switch and that was that. I thought it was. I was psyched. First time I really entered a really deep state of contentment, I was like, wow, so it's going to be like this forever? Bam, hit a brick wall. And that's part of it, right? We're not trying to get this constant, we're trying to, but we're not going to. And it's fine. You know, we learn from these moments when we're totally lost. And we learn, even if we don't like them, we learn from the moments when we're not. And part of the freedom also comes in terms of seeing that it is transient, that in the midst of this balance, there is transience. There is movement. And we don't have to hold on to it in order to have this sense of okayness with it. Doesn't mean we don't get sad when things pass or we lose things. You know? But we don't cling to them. We say, oh yeah, I'm really sad. And observing and being with nature is another way of cultivating equanimity. Literally, just looking at the bay and the vast expansiveness of the bay, or watching the blue heron in flight. moving but not really seeming like it's hurting. And sometimes we can just be present and allow things to just be what they are, even if they're things we don't like. We can allow ourselves to be. Like sometimes I'll have a sit where my mind is just going, right? And for years I thought, okay, well, that's just a failed sit. And then I learned, oh, well, I can just sit and watch the mind just do its thing. And I'm just not getting involved in it, not trying to control it, right? But letting it just be there, it's not a problem if I'm letting it be there. It's this idea I have that calmness good, agitated mind bad, right? But really, if I let it be there, it's going to settle on its own, and I'm okay if it doesn't, because I'm practicing just being present with it. So I want to end with a slightly lengthy poem about, not to be misinterpreted as letting everything just be as it is always, but sometimes being present and not doing anything is a wise thing to do. And most of the world tends to unfold on its own. And the times when we need to take action or take a stand are much less, oftentimes, in the course of the day than we think. So this apparently is by a Tibetan Lama. And I guess the story is that in the middle of a talk, he just came up with this poem. It just came to him. And it's called Free and Easy. And it's by the Venerable Lama Gendun Rinpoche. It's also a call to spontaneous Vajra song. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do or undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all, has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with it and become attached to it, passing judgment upon it and ourselves? Far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears magically, again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as an actual thing or place, it is always available and accompanies you every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good or bad experiences. They're like today's ephemeral weather, like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there, open, inviting, and comfortable. Make use of this spaciousness, this freedom and natural ease. Don't search any further, looking for the great awakened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. I'm going to read that line again. I love it. Don't search any further, looking for the great awakened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. Nothing to do or undo, nothing to force, nothing to want, and nothing missing. Imaho, marvelous, everything happens by itself. Maybe we'll just sit for a minute.